So for this class, what I want to do is just recap very briefly what we did yesterday and just map the scope of what I can manage to do on the Bhagavad Gita for this short session. So Mahabharata, yeah, we did it in 1 hour and 20 minutes yesterday. What we focused on was Dharma, while acknowledging that the Mahabharata is a repository of all the most of the big ideas within Hindu traditions. Dharma is the big issue. We explored a little the tensions, sometimes the conflicts between trying to know how to apply Dharma. What's the right thing to do at the right time, in the right way? It's a conundrum. And simplistically, we sketched Sometimes we see a tension between these particular understandings of karma. So we have, on the one hand, we had all the things you do in your bodily, social environment. So it's things that will help purify, refine, uplift the consciousness, things, ritualistic performances, giving in charity, going on pilgrimage, doing yajñas, all of these kind of ritualistic activities that in somehow refine the self. In this doing pravritti or dharmas to apply in the bodily social sphere, we also saw things like this three dharma. What's your gender? So for a woman, there'll be another particular prescribed set of duties. Then again, there's the whole realm of social duty. What is your responsibility within society? Now, in particular, the Mahabharata deals with the duty of kings and perhaps that of the Brahmins and the tension that's between how a king should act, what his social responsibilities and duties are, and how, like Yudhisthira, sometimes he appears a little more brahminical and gentle in his demeanour and wishes to renege on his responsibilities. So we have all of that, the sphere of the body, the social. We had also the ascetic ethics, the more the dharma that applies to one who's putting an emphasis more on the underpinning Atman, the post-mortem realities, that this body, this social reality, is not all that there is, that there's something more. And the tendencies there for that are to renounce or move away from the entanglements of family, responsibilities of wife and children, perhaps move to a solitary place, focus on jnana, on knowledge, perhaps meditation, perhaps yoga practices, perhaps just going a little more inward, removing yourself from the hustle and bustle of social life. And so that's the ascetic ethics. And here are the social realities, the social duties, responsibilities. And then we had the universal virtues that we see within all religions of the saintly person, the general dharmas of the saintly person. So you have honesty, truthfulness, kindness, non-harming, compassion, not stealing, all of these good qualities recognizable by everyone. We added into the mix then the word sukshma. That, whatever else, dharma is a tricky thing. There is no one size fits all. There's no simplistic black and white answers. It's very nuanced. There's a lot of grey areas. And really, it seems that the Mahabharata is asking the question, what is the character of the one who knows dharma? Welcome. We're just doing a brief recap on yesterday before moving on. We have enough places? Yes.
I think it's possible to move the board a little to the middle. Mm-hmm.
Any better? Okay. So, this idea. Yudhisthira saying, I can feel it in my heart. It's something to be intuited by the intellect of the refined, cultured individual. And then, of course, we have Krishna throwing a spanner in the works and he challenging rigid adherence to absolute truthfulness, never telling a lie. And he introduces the general principle of whatever is for the welfare of everybody, the welfare of all. And that, in one sense, resonates with the root of the meaning of dharma dhrit, to sustain, to uphold, to hold together. So, for the welfare of all living beings. And it's a general principle that must be applied by the discriminating, qualified person according to the time, according to the circumstance, and according to the individual at hand. Who is this person? What is their responsibility? What is the particular circumstance in which we need to apply this? So there's lots of relatives that need to be weighed up. And again, Mahabharata, what is the character of that person? Seems the Mahabharata favors Yudhisthira for whatever questions arise around him. He's regarded as the Dharmaraj. That was yesterday. So today, we're moving to the Bhagavad Gita, which continues this discussion or exploration of Dharma and offers a reconciliation of some of these seemingly conflicted. Should Yudhisthira do his duty as a king, or should he renounce it and give up this dirty fighting ideas and become an ascetic and just not get involved in the ugliness of war? But interestingly, the Bhagavad Gita starts with Arjuna taking the role of Yudhisthira. So far, what we've heard of Yudhisthira and his virtues and his unwillingness to engage in the bloody ghastliness of dog fighting, the Kshatriya king dharma of war, it's now in the voice of Arjuna. The Bhagavad Gita is located in the Mahabharata. It's in the sixth book, the Bhishma Parvan. And it starts, it's poised at the very beginning of the great battle. Now, what the Mahabharata has told us, it's told us of the story that leads up to this great battle. In no uncertain terms, it's made it clear that Yudhisthira and the Pandavas have tried to avoid this war at all costs. I say this because in teaching, I've often encountered non-Hindu people who say, oh, this Bhagavad Gita, this god of yours, you know, he's a god of ghastly warfare. He just, you know, you read your so-called Bible, the Bible of the Hindus, and he's a god who advocates killing. So the context within which the Bhagavad Gita finds itself is very important, because it leaves you in no uncertain terms that Yudhisthira is loath. He has absolutely no self-motivation for this war. It is merely for the welfare of all. So the context of the Mahabharata gives a rationale for the teachings of Krishna that are presented in the 700 verses that comprise the Bhagavad Gita. Perhaps it's one of the, probably the most well-known Hindu scripture of all. How important was it? Well, it seems that it was always important. We know going back to, as far back as Shankaracharya in the 8th century, he's the great teacher of the Advaita Vedanta. He did a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita and included it as one of the foundations, the Prasthanatraya, the three great foundations of Hindu ideas, Vedantic thought. So you have the Upanishads, you have the Vedanta Sutras, the sort of the condensed aphorisms, and you have the Bhagavad Gita. So we know that there were commentaries before that, but there's not much evidence. We don't have much to go on. But Shankaracharya sort of set the stage for, if you want to be a serious acharya or teacher, you must comment on the Bhagavad Gita. And so we have Ramanujacharya coming in the 11th century. He comments in response to Shankaracharya on the Bhagavad Gita, contesting the views of reality. Shankaracharya would present the Advaita, which is basically Krishna is non-different from Brahman, the all-pervading monistic understanding. And Ramanujacharya presents his, opposing Vishishta Advaita, which is, yes, everything is one in spirit ultimately, but not completely. There's a little qualified oneness. So there is distinction between the deity and the individual. So he goes for distinction. Later on, we have in the 13th century, Madhvacharya, another great teacher in this dualistic devotional tradition, who again follows on from Ramanujacharya's insistence that ultimate reality is personal, it's not absolute monism, but he just makes it stronger, and that it's actually absolutely true. God is big and great, we are tiny and little, and never the twain shall meet. He emphasizes difference, the littleness of the individual soul and the greatness of the absolute soul. So, big commentators within the tradition have referred to the Bhagavad Gita. In the colonial period, one of the earliest translations of English scripture was Sir Charles Wilkins in 1785, could be six, but I think it's five, translated the Bhagavad Gita into English. He was one of Sir William Jones' Sanskrit experts who were appreciating the wonders of the Sanskrit heritage of these Indian people. And they were admirers of the ideas in this early phase of colonial history. The Bhagavad Gita from then, once it was translated to India in English, kind of sort of went on a journey to Europe, influenced German philosophers and beyond, and, you know, basically charting a very brief overview since then, it has become more and more a centralized text of the Hindu tradition. This has been partly because of the getting caught up in the journey of India towards nationalism and from post-colonial period. So it became, I suppose, attention given to it by its translation in the early colonial period. As India moved towards independence, it became the Hindu Bible to counter Christian claims that we have our Bible and that the Hindus have got so much nonsense. In the words of T.B. Macaulay, he was a famous educationalist within the colonial period. Have you heard of him?
Thomas
Babington Macaulay. I'd rather TB because it gives that sense of disease.
The natives.
Yes, and basically, what do you remember his phrase? What he had as a dismissal of all of the Indian sacred texts.
They cannot change the color of the skin of the natives. But in every other way, we will make them think and be British.
That was the idea, and that was opposed to the earlier colonists were actually a little bit more open. And he said that one shelf of a Western library would beat all of the knowledge within Sanskrit or Hindu teachings. Just one shelf of a Western philosophy. The Western philosophical inquiry was superior to. So you had that shift from earlier, more appreciative of the early Orientalists, to, I suppose, when they have a foothold stronger with business, you can just be a little less concerned about pleasing the natives. Anyway, the point being, the gradual move towards independence of India used the Bhagavad Gita as the centralizing text. So this development towards one nation, one creed, one text, the Bhagavad Gita became used or a tool in that development. It's also much more accessible. Let's say the Mahabharata, the Puranas, you know, the Upanishads, the Vedas, where do you start? They're so vast. But the Bhagavad Gita, 700 verses, you know, it's a pretty, well, this is actually, you know, it's a succinct text on a par with perhaps it's actually more concise than the Bible. So you have something to use, something to unite, because the varying traditions within Hinduism, because the Bhagavad Gita has a piece of everything. It's multivalent, has many messages. And while if you take the Bhagavad Gita as a whole, it would be difficult to argue against it being predominantly a devotional, theistic text. If you look at its component parts, you can certainly find those there. So, Bhagavad Gita, very important in the early commentarial tradition. Important in the development of Indian independence. Tilak, famous nationalist, he did a commentary on the Gita Rahasya, moving the ideas within the Gita into a more political sphere and applying them to the national politics of the day. So, yeah, the journey of the Bhagavad Gita is a study in itself, and the scope of the class doesn't allow me, but I just wished to briefly chart the importance of the text, both in the past, in the journey of the colonial period, and today it has perhaps its most important, well-known as a Hindu scripture. Right, back to the Bhagavad Gita itself. What I want to do is look at the key ideas and in light of the context of its location in the Mahabharata. There are some scholars who would argue that the Bhagavad Gita has nothing to do with the Mahabharata, well, insofar as that it's an interpolation, and that it can be studied separately, and there's no need to understand the context of the Mahabharata. There are others who will argue against that and say, actually, no. To understand the Bhagavad Gita, you need to understand the context of the Mahabharata. Whatever the differing arguments, what is clear is that to some extent, the Bhagavad Gita, or to a great extent, the Mahabharata addresses the dilemmas that are explored in the Mahabharata. And we'll look a little bit at how it does that. So, on the battlefield, well, we won't go yet. The beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, let me just read the very first verse and how it starts. It's, look, who knows the name of the field? Sanjay, yes. Sanjay, who's Sanjay?
He's the one who has the
Drishti. Oh, you know it all already. Yeah, exactly. And who is he telling it to?
Dhritarashtra.
Exactly. So already the context is within, we know who Dhritarashtra is from the Mahabharata. We know who this character is and all his angst of should I, shouldn't I, you know, this kind of mixed character torn between good and evil and his son. And Sanjay is reciting this to him because he's been given divine vision by Vyas. But the very first words then are Dharma Kshetra, Kuru Kshetra. On the field of Dharma, on the field of Kuru. So straight away then we've got Samaveta Yuyutsavan. They're assembled together desiring to fight. Mamaka, Pandava, Chaiva, mine and the sons of Pandava, Kim Makuruvata Sanjaya. What did they do, Sanjaya? So from the very start, it's about Dharma, on the field of Dharma. So it's going to address those verses. The very last verse of the Bhagavad Gita also uses the term Dharma. So in terms of continuing the exploration or contributing to the debate on Dharma, yes, the Bhagavad Gita is very significant. So what happens at the start? You have Arjuna, and he is articulating what we have up to this point heard in the mouth of Yudhisthira. In fact, he starts off with a listing of adharmic activity. Can you remember any of the things he says? Well, what's his argument? What's his stance?
Women will be debased.
Right. The point is, does he want to fight?
No.
No, exactly like you. Did Yudhisthira want to fight? No, Yudhisthira abhorred the ugliness of fighting. So Arjuna doesn't want to fight. Why?
He finds all his seniors in front of him whom he doesn't want to.
Exactly. Relatives. How is that dharmic to kill your relatives? Yeah. Not just your relatives. Who else is there?
Your guru.
Who? Your teachers. And who else?
Your grandfather.
Not only that, the grandsire, Bhishma. I mean, I can't explain. I mean, I couldn't express how important Bhishma is. He is the pillar of the dynasty of Hastinapur. So there they are. He knows them all. And they're lying there. And what's Krishna saying? Go on, Arjuna. Kill them. Fight. So basically, Arjuna has a nervous breakdown. It's like he sees what's in front of him. Now, do you remember yesterday? We had this. Yes, I'm a talented artist. Gifted. But this is the one I want to look at now. Do you remember what this diagram indicated? What was it?
Self, social, cosmic.
Yes, so we see this in throughout all of the scriptures, this oscillation between different layers, levels of reality. We talked about there's the within, there's the social without, and then there's this beyond. And it's like they may be nuanced differently or given more details, but in general, it's like, and you have this oscillation between the virtues within, what's your motivation, what's your character, then your social duties, how you should behave to the world around you. But then the beyond, what about the Atma stuff? What about post-mortem? What about karma and retribution after life? Well, so it's expansive vision, shrunken vision, this constant thing. So we find Arjuna, in which of these is he?
In the center.
All right. Now, I find this interesting. I'm a little dyslexic sometimes when I say words. And this was one. He's looking out on the battlefield, and no, he's not smiling. And he sees his... This term I've read in many of his kinsmen. But one day I was reading it and I saw he sees skin men. And I thought, and I just thought, actually, that's what he sees. He sees skin men. He sees everybody in their bodily form. He sees the skin men in front of him. And so Arjuna's vision is this, and the dharma is that of the world, a social context. And according to that, he sees only adharma. If you kill these warriors, what's going to happen? All the men will be killed. Then what happens to the women? The women are left unprotected. If the women are left unprotected, then they all get pregnant and have unwanted children because they will be unprotected and they will be... it goes on. Plus also the ritual activities, those purifying things you must do, sacred yajnas, the offerings to the forefathers, pinda, will not be forced. So there will be inauspiciousness. So it's all bad, Krishna. So that's the start of what Krishna doesn't, he doesn't see it. Now, I find it very interesting that even though Arjuna is having this literal meltdown, which is completely connected to perspective. Now, if I were to say anything about the Gita, it's about, the main idea is about perspective. Yes, perspective to do with dharma, how do you act? Perspective to do with the self, who is the nature, what's the nature of the self? Perspective, what is the nature of the world around us? What is the nature of the deity? So it's giving you vision, drish, try to expand your perspective. So the very first thing Krishna does when Arjuna does this, when he actually refuses to fight, is he smiles. I find it interesting. He doesn't just, you know, say, oh, it's, you know, you poor thing, Arjuna. Oh, it's terrible. I agree with you. It's awful. You know, come on, Arjuna. It's going to be okay. He does none of that. He does none of that kind of cajoling or encouraging. So he's having a meltdown, and Krishna stands there and he smiles. I often wonder, what's the smile? Is the smile like a child? You know, it's like, oh, sweet. Is it a loving smile, or is it like just, he just smiles, doesn't say why he smiles, it's just that smile. And it's like, perhaps it's, you know, did you ever see a child when they're having an absolute meltdown? And yeah, it's over because they can't have a sweet. And you see the parents, the bigger context is there's actually nothing wrong, the child is fine. But for the child, it's the end of the world. It's the absolute end of the world. There is no thing further than I'm not allowed to have this lollipop and I could die. And it's like, and then you see the parent looking on, looking at each other, and they've got the bigger context. So without reducing Arjuna to the status of a child and a lollipop, what I'm trying to do is the perspective thing. Arjuna sees things in one way, on one level, and he's crippled by that perspective. How he sees, how he understands, spills over into behavior. This is the point we were making, the purpose of sacred texts. It gives knowledge, but knowledge that within the tradition that is to teach and to ultimately spill over into transformation. Within the tradition, that's its function, a didactic function. So here we find this Arjuna, this vision spills over into inaction, in incapacity, crippled behavior. So we don't have time to go through all of what Krishna says, but I'm going to dip into some of the ideas he does to reconstitute Arjuna's vision and how it ties with the Mahabharata. The first thing Krishna does, actually, is gives this perspective. He gives the biggest picture. And he says, never was there a time when you nor I, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So from going from this, you know, more reduced vision, he gives the biggest, broadest context, the Atma. And then chapter 2, 20 verses of this or so are about the nature of the soul. But it's a bit too soon for Arjuna to get it. But it's just interesting. He counters with this reducement with the bigger picture again, oscillating from the little to the big. But Arjuna's inaction is because of he cannot act. And in fact, he wants to run away. He wants to, rather I would live by begging than to live at the cost of the lives of others. I would rather become an ascetic and renounce this horrible duty. Who said that in the Mahabharata? Who is exactly the one who says that?
He also wanted to, he would rather give up everything than be in this dilemma. So we see the opposing, like back to our Dharma thing again, as we sweep around here. This versus this, they're in conflict. How can you reconcile these? So one of the biggest ideas in the Bhagavad Gita is this reconciliation. And it's about doing your duty, karma, acting in the world, but making it a renunciation, a yoga. So it's not just doing your, it's actually karma yoga. And it brings the two, you renounce, you have this negating or renunciant attitude within. You don't literally have to leave the battlefield. You don't literally have to move away. You renounce the results of your activities. So instead of doing your duty because that will bring good results, that will bring proper rewards, that will keep everything working together, you do it without any attachment to gain or benefit. You do it like you, you fight with no hankering for name, fame, fortune, expectation of anything. So in that way, the two kind of become reconciled, or it offers a reconciliation of two seemingly opposing opposites. Now, I'll stop there, because I think what we'll do is read a text which explains that in a little more detail, so you actually hear the tone of the text itself, and we can ask questions about it. The text I'm going to give you is from chapter 4, when Krishna explains to Arjuna what this means, how he wants him to act, but in this radically, not for name or gain or form, all the things that Arjuna didn't want to do. What good would we enjoy this kingdom if we fight? What's the point? We couldn't be happy if we gain prosperity in the kingdom. So Arjuna has depicted the results of fighting. So Krishna's like, forget about the results. Let me tell you this. So pass these round. And it's the second excerpt. Okay, has everyone got a sheet? Somebody a short? Hands up who doesn't have? No, everybody does. Okay. So, what we'll do is just read this text together. As we're reading it, I want you to just understand something you don't understand, and then after a while say, what's being said here? What's the idea here? Do you understand it? Any questions? Would you like to start just verse by verse from chapter 4?
Right from the beginning?
Or no, the second excerpt. Right from the beginning here.
One who perceives inaction, and action in inaction is intelligent amongst men. He is properly engaged and he performs all his designated actions.
Mm-hmm. Moving on.
Do you want me to continue? Or
no, next.
When all a person's endeavors are devoid of any inclination towards desire, his action is burned by the fire of knowledge. The wise ones describe such a person as a learned pundit.
When a person gives up attachment for the fruits of action, is always satisfied and is not dependent on any other. He performs no action at all, even though he's engaged in action.
By remaining free of expectations, returning to thoughts, practicing self-control, giving up all desires for acquisitions, and acting only for the maintenance of the body, a person remains free of contamination.
If he is satisfied with whatever befall him, transcends duly, is free of envy, and is equal in success and failure, then even though he engaged in action, he is not beyond
Okay. What do you think? No, just stop there for a moment. That there's those few verses. What's the big idea? What's
importance of action and not
the fruits of action?
Yeah, now sometimes it's difficult to get your head around it. So one who does inaction in action or action in inaction. So let's start with what's he mean when he says inaction in action? What does that mean?
Without the pursuit of the fruits of the action, you act correctly.
So
it's not reaction, but action.
So that inaction is the state of being within. You're not, there's a stillness, there's a detachedness from the result within. Insofar as that is, that's the inactive bit, because you're not grasping. It's not like you're, you know, I want, you're not,
this.
Yeah, you're not going to be stuck. It doesn't stick to you. It's actually, you're going to do it because it's the right thing to do. What about the other one? What about action in inaction? What's that?
Your desire to have that.
Even when you're not.
So inaction, say if you do nothing. So it's like Arjuna says.
Even that is,
that's a decision.
That is an action.
Spot on. Inaction.
Exactly. Yeah. So don't just think by giving up your duty, I'm not going to do it, Arjuna. I can't fight. I'm not playing. Or I'm not doing it. It's like, that's actually an action. It will cause a response. Because why?
There's a consequence.
Yeah, but what's the motivation? It's for selfish gain in one sense. I don't want to fight. It's like it's so you're attached. It's not a detail. So in that reason, the inaction, it's not really inaction. There's an action in it.
Correct.
Is that clear? Sometimes it's tricky, and you can do your head in going inaction, action, inaction, inaction.
It's like. When you don't make a decision, you are making a decision.
Exactly. You can't. So you think you're passive, and you think you're not. Yeah, exactly. You think you're not doing anything, but you are. It's a choice by doing that. And that's what Arjuna was. He was choosing not to fight. And actually, that's not even the position of someone who's a pacifist who doesn't want. The conscience had already blown. The fight, the battle had begun. So he was already started. It's not as if he wants to say and be, you know, passive. Well, actually, I'm not really for war. He was there. It had begun. And that's when he was having his crisis. Okay, any other thoughts on that?
Well, this is very hard. It's nice to say it, but it's very hard to do, right?
Yes.
It's almost impossible for most people.
Yes, and I think that's a good point. It says also of this knowledge, where we're talking about the function of these texts is to transmit knowledge, but it's not ordinary knowledge. It's not just like, yeah, read that, got it down. You know, karma yoga? Karma yoga is actually when you're detached from the action within and actually you don't have the... Yeah. And then, it's like, and then my mother rings me and I say, oh, mom, go away. And who was the gentleman who made that very good point yesterday? Is he here today? You did. You made that very point that actually... The simple message is that good conquers over evil. But you're quite right. But actually, it's in the nitty-gritty of the how and the when and the where that the challenges arise, in the human's dilemmas and circumstances. It's not so easy. So it's not a...
basically, dharmic duty over consequences.
Pardon?
Dharmic duty over consequences is the...
Yes,
what
do you
dharmic duty?
Yeah. That is, of course, is partially defined here. But it's the overall text of...
This idea of doing your duty detached from the fruits. Exactly. So that's the big idea. One big idea is this idea of karma yoga. So you do your action, but it's a yoga. Now, this word yoga, it has multivarious meanings, but it comes from the word yuge, which has...
Join.
Or to yoke, the English word to yoke with. So what it attempts to do, again, it's like these... It's to yoke the human... reality, the human plane of existence with the divine. So it's kind of making that connection, a yuga. And it can be many things. In the Vedic periods it was doing the yajna, is the yoke, is the reaching out to the bigger picture. It later became meditation, yoga, inwardness, looking inwards. But the same purposes, you do these rituals and you do these meditations, the purpose is to yoke.
It could also be to connect the mind with the action and not to, you know, have any other thoughts in between.
Well,
so you're directly connecting the mind to the action that you have to do, that is the war, engage in war.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a mental connect.
You make a good point. A lot of this is to do with the mind and what the mind is absorbed in and how the mind sees things, the perception
of the mind.
But the mind
can have a negative thought, isn't it?
And who's having the negative thought at the moment? Who's having the negative thought at the moment?
Krishna is inspiring him not to have the negative thought and to just connect the mind with the other.
But his negative thought is based on perception, on vision,
yeah.
How he sees. Again, we're here with these oscillating realities. What is the nature of the self in reality? So Arjuna's right down there in the social. Krishna's trying to show him, you know, the Atman. Ultimately, he goes in chapter 11 to show him something that literally blows his mind and he can't handle. But that's further on. So right now here, karma yoga, a big idea. You can renounce Arjuna. I'm asking you to do this, detach from the action. But that's not where it stops. And we'll say how karma yoga, being detached from your action, becomes attached to me. Do you get that? So then you see, you get this karma yoga thing becoming a bhakti, a devotional, relational reality between the deity and his devotee. So this is a big idea in the Bhagavad Gita as a devotional text. We see Krishna, the avatar, the deity, actually offering Arjuna this a relational reality whereby he helps him. He offers grace and mercy in a way that you don't have to just do it. Just do it for me and I'll look after the results. Mm-hmm. So the karma yoga is about you doing the action, being detached, you know, from the results, having no fruitive desires. And Krishna says, listen, just absorb your mind. You mentioned mind. Absorb your mind in me and I'll look after it. I'll be the one who looks after that. So we go ahead of ourselves. So right now, karma yoga is a big idea. Actually, since I've said that, can you jump to your second page, Divine Grace? It's for the excerpt 4.2. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Third page, you're quite right. Third page, 4.2, it says Divine Grace. Since I've mentioned that now, I'll just show this. This is what this image is of here. The first four verses here, would somebody like to continue reading where we stopped? We're in the 12th chapter, verses 6 to 7. This is, again, much farther on now. The previous reading was in chapter 4, now we're in chapter 12. So I'm jumping, but I want to just show you two ideas. Continue.
For those who are devoted to me, who dedicate all their actions to me, who meditate on me and worship me through single-pointed yoga, I become without delay the uplifter from the ocean of death and rebirth, for their consciousness is absorbed in me.
Next one.
Set your mind on me alone. Let your intellect enter into me. You will then dwell in me alone. Of this, there is no doubt.
Okay, just stop there. So,
is me the Atma?
No,
Krishna.
Yes.
Is it to demand the consciousness?
Now, you have it's a good point you made, because some commentators, for example, Shankaracharya, will say Krishna is really the fully realized Atma. And in essential, Arjuna and Krishna are ultimately one and the same. That's it. And it has been read like that, and that's for sure. But there are others who read it that actually Krishna is the personal, separate deity who has a relational with, who is never completely one with Krishna. Now, these schools of thought, will continually debate this. Personally, I think the Gita, taken as a whole, it's difficult to argue completely against the dualistic reality of Krishna. If you take portions of it, much easier to. It's clear there's lots of clearly Advaitin treatises. But it has been done. I think Shankaracharya has better ground with the Upanishads, for example. He's it's easier to argue for it here. Because we've just read a little bit of some of the verses. If you interpret Krishna as ultimately Atman, then yes, you reconcile the two completely. But here, it's this idea of not doing it alone, that I will take the result of your action. So This idea of grace, our mercy, is introduced. Of, I am the swift deliverer of the from the ocean of the eternal ocean of misery. I am the swift deliverer. So you get this idea of, it's almost like a salvationist attitude here. So it's not just Christianity has the redeemer salvationist idea of God. We find it here in by this, I will uplift you from the ocean of death, mrtya, from death and rebirth. So this samsara sagarat, eternal cycle of death and rebirth.
But you could also get to where Namita's going with that, by internalizing, taking it all metaphorically, and saying this is a dialogue between your ego.
Yes, and you can read it like that. Yes, you can read it like that. Yes, you can read it like that. And again, as I said, if you want to see the variants read it, you will look at the commentators and they will read it like that in those two ways. Either way, the teaching of Krishna is basically saying that this higher spiritual reality, be it the personal Krishna or the higher understanding of the Atma, will relieve you from the cycle of birth and death. Okay. I think the difficulty with the Advaitin thing about this grace and mercy thing, in one sense, if you dissolve the reality of the separate Krishna and the individual Atma into an absolute oneness, then there isn't that relational reality whereby mercy and grace actually take effect. You need two to have mercy and grace. You can't have relational reality with one. And it's ultimately your choice, but that's just some of the difficulty about that. If we're going to discuss ideas in the Gita of reciprocity, of relational reality, of grace and of mercy...
Yeah,
you need the two for that, and that's the difficult. They're the tricky bits.
I'm just saying, unless you're a bit schizophrenic, then you
can. Well, absolutely. Then it gets more than two. Okay. So, yeah, the big idea, karma yoga, then becomes you'd be detached from the fruits of the action, the results. But later on in the Gita, he develops it. Actually, Arjuna, I want you to become attached to me. Finally, just the two other ideas before we read the last one is go back to the third excerpt. The characteristics of one who knows this karma yoga. He says, the characteristics of a buddhi yoga. Here. So we've gone back to chapter 2 because here is where Krishna begins to explain about a person. A buddhi yoga is a person who is in understanding of this idea, who has developed intellect. Buddhi is intellect or understanding. It's pretty much the same as someone who understands karma yoga. So he describes this. And continue reading, just down to verse 64.
So starting from 54?
Starting from 54 to stop at 60, the end of 63.
Yeah. Arjuna said, what is the defining feature of a person whose realization is steady and who remains firm in his concentration, Keshava? How does such a steady-minded person speak? How does he sit? How does he move?
The Lord said, when a person sets aside all the desires running through his mind, Partha, and satisfies himself in the Self alone, he is then described as one whose wisdom is steady.
When the mind does not grieve over life's sorrows, when a person remains untouched by the joys of life and free passion, fear and anger, he is described as a sage whose understanding is steady.
When a person has no affection for any object at all and feels neither joy nor loathing when he gains desirable and unwanted results, then his wisdom is firmly established.
When a person withdraws all his senses from their objects, like a tortoise withdrawing its limbs, then his wisdom is firmly established.
The objects of pleasure do not touch the embodied soul who abstains from them. In this way, one restricts one's inclination, although the inclination remains. But after perceiving the Supreme One, completely renounces such desires.
The agitating senses can forcibly carry away the mind of even a perceptive person who makes the proper endeavors, Kanteya.
Restraining
all these senses, one engaged in this practice should remain dedicated to me. When he has his senses under control, then his wisdom is firmly established.
When a person thinks about the objects of the senses, attachment for them inevitably arises. Due to that attachment, desire appears, and from desire, anger comes into being.
Okay, that just teases us out a little more. Are there any questions or comments on that description? It has that, how does such a person speak? It's not just a theoretical understanding. We talked about this in the Mahabharata. What does this person look like? It's not just what does he say. You know, well, that's part of it. How does he speak? But how does he hold himself in the world? How does he act? How does he walk in the world? So this is the knowledge. If you get it, it spills over into transformation.
The
sthita pragya, the one who's fixed in knowledge, the one who's fixed in buddhi, in intelligence, the one who understands karma yoga. Are there any...
Is the idea of chit ki ekagrata.
Yes.
This is a higher developed consciousness. Are there any points that struck you about this behavior that you wanted to say something on or a question?
Yeah, I have one. Satisfies himself in the self alone.
Yeah.
We wanted to go away from the self.
Okay, what does the self... You're very good. Now, here we have our little... Which self are we talking about?
The highest.
The expansive self, the underpinning Atma self. It's not just, you know, I'd like to have the bodily, sensual, the needs of the self. It's more than that. Yeah, it's the real underpinning self. Yeah. Anybody else got it?
The cosmic.
Yeah, the Atma. The Atma. Anybody else got something? That about the characteristics of this person, how does he walk? Because Arjuna says, tell me about him. And so Krishna...
Does the Gita talk about the Atma being in all of us? Therefore, we are also part of the Atma.
Yes.
You're looking inward for everything that you need. It's in you already.
Yes, ultimately that's what the message is, that the underpinning reality is the spiritual. I mean, if there's anything that unites all the complexities of Hindu traditions, is I think pretty much all Hindu traditions recognize an underpinning spiritual reality. How they understand it is nuanced in how they understand. But generally speaking, reality is both, it's got an ephemeral, temporal, topsoil level, and it's got an underpinning, enduring spiritual reality. Now, I think pretty much all Hindu, you can correct me there, Julius, if I'm wrong, I think that's the basic unifying point of it. But then I said the nuance and how you understand that spiritual reality, is it Advaitin, is it all absolute oneness? Are there, you know, is it ultimately, is there an individual reality in post and all that? Yeah.
In the Gita, doesn't Krishna distinguish between Gyan Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, and Karma Yoga, right?
Yeah.
But here you said something about when we started reading this thing on Buddhi Yoga.
Yes.
That it leads, this is about karma. I'm a little confused.
It is a little confusing because sometimes the terms are Buddhi Yoga, when it's used here in the second chapter, is pretty much interchangeable with Karma Yoga. It's like the understanding of working in the world. As a yoga, as a yoking with the divine. It's not just working on this level for the needs of the body. You just mentioned that traditionally the Bhagavad Gita was divided into sections. I think it was Yamunacharya from the Sri Vaishnav tradition in the south. You know, he gave the division of the chapters into the first six chapters might be called Karma Yoga. The middle six chapters devoted to Bhakti Yoga, and the final six chapters considered Jnana Yoga, dealing with the... But that's a rough division that's often referred to. But there's a lot of... It's confusing because the knowledge... What's the knowledge? Well, the knowledge can sometimes be the knowledge of Sankhya, the nature of the world, the nature of the self within. Here in the chapter 2, this knowledge they're talking about is the knowledge of the Sthita Priya, one who's fixed in the understanding of the self, the Atma, and how to act in a manner that's detached from the results. So there is a little confusion because it can be overlapping at times. Did anybody have anything to say about the qualities of the characteristics of this person who walks?
Action.
Yeah.
Detachment.
Pardon?
Action with detachment.
Exactly. Atman and with detachment, which is why I put this here, because I thought the metaphor of the tortoise encapsulates it. Did you, what is the...
Withdraws. He goes in. Tortoise goes in.
Yes.
Not affected by
yes.
what follows.
But there's a point. How does he withdraw?
Takes his senses. Or his limbs inside.
Centers himself.
Yes. At will. At will. Not just because you go boo and I go like this. No, because he's self-controlled. He's actually in control of the pushings and the urges of the bodily self. Because he's in this higher knowledge that he can withdraw the senses. And he can... So that image of the tortoise sort of encapsulates the qualities of the one fixed in this knowledge.
It also requires a very tough shell.
Pardon?
Yes, exactly.
A tough shell.
Yeah, nice one. I hadn't thought of that. That's very good. He has a tough, nice one. Things can just brought off that you're actually fixed and firm in your understanding. Yes, very, very nice.
I also found that the image of a person that came to mind was somebody who is very calm.
Yeah.
You stay calm and still through anything that is going
yes,
on.
Yes, this idea of equipoised, equipoised. Yeah. Now, when you read the Mahabharata, you don't see an awful lot of equipoised people.
Equanimity.
So equanimity, that's the word, thank you. But that's interesting, but stillness within, so it doesn't mean that you're walking around like this, yes, Mom, I will do my homework. There's also an engagement with the world, but within, you see success and failure, honor and dishonor, ups and downs of life, with a certain detachment, and yet, of course, you respond in the world emotionally, but there's a certain stillness within, yes. Doesn't mean cold, it means a security of this bigger perspective, that you're not just limited and this is the all in all. It's like, okay, like you, this dear, I see for the welfare of all, I will, there's a bigger picture going on here. You have something, yes?
It's sort of, one of the questions I had was the distinction between equanimity and sort of repressive. Because there's an element.
Yeah.
Think of the tortoise. Because if you go to Western therapy, you're all about
not
controlling your emotions. So it's not simply withdrawing the senses, but it's actually redefining the perspective for the senses, for the withdrawal.
That's a brilliant point. And it goes back to the point of if this is real knowledge or it's just theoretical knowledge. And it says in the Gita, Samahatma Sudurlaba, this is a very rare, a mahatma is a very rare knowledge. So if you're just faking it, it'll end up as repressive. But if you actually see with these eyes, and this is your perspective, you actually get it, then it's like it naturally spills over into behavior. You understand it. It's not like...
knowing and withdrawing.
Yeah.
Knowing and withdrawing.
So if you take any one of these elements, which just talks of withdrawing, it's almost...
You withdraw with knowledge.
Unless you combine it with the knowing.
I think withdrawal is automatic. It's not a conscious action. Because when you understand things, you automatically...
Well,
it's what happens...
It's basically... It doesn't mean that you have to constantly go around withdrawing. It means that you're not pushed by the urges of the senses. It means that you are not going through life because, oh, I need this, oh, I need that, and God, I want that, and that you're not driven by avarice and power and lust for creatures, or you're a sex maniac, or you have to have alcohol, and you're pushed... by the demands of your body. That's what the point is that actually you've a little bit of self-restraint.
Yeah, because of out of understanding,
yes.
Not out of repression.
Not out of repression, which is back to you. Exactly.
Or repression or guilt.
Yeah.
For example, your super ego.
Exactly. You have to get this.
There has to be some realization.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a knowledge. It's a realization.
Okay, listen, I'm going to give you an example. Right, we're going to move on to this. You read here 262, 263. These verses, I think, are the most wonderful application of human psychology. You can forget dogmatic religion or 62 and 63. Now, you've read them already. I'm going to read them again, and I'm going to set you a task. When a person thinks about the objects of the senses, so you think about something, right? Dhyana, you meditate on something. These two verses tell you how we lose perspective, how it is that we get upset, how we end up suffering, or like Arjuna, how we end up in a despondent condition. And this is the cycle of how it happens. So I want you to think of a time when you really were unhappy, very miserable. You don't have to say it, but think in your mind a time when you were very, very unhappy. Okay? Things did not work out and you're really down. Okay, this is what happens. It's according to the Gita. When a person thinks about the objects of the senses, dhyana, you meditate on them. There's something you want, all right? It can be a person, it can be a success, it can be a thing, but there's something that you have desired. You're meditating on this. And then from this comes attachment to that desire, sangha. It's an attachment. You're stuck to it. You want this.
So it all starts with a little thought.
It starts with the meditation, yeah, and the desire. That you meditate on the desire, and then it becomes stuck. It becomes firmer. Then this is frustrated. Frustrated desire. What happens to frustrated desire? Anger comes because it's taken from you. So you're stuck on it. And because this is the one thing in front of your head, you can't see over here. You can't see the big picture. Forget the Atma. You're looking here. Yeah. And it's like anger arises. It's like, I didn't get it. Think of the kid with the lollipop. It's the end of the world if you pull the lollipop off them. So this is anger arise. What happens when anger comes? Delusion. Why does delusion? It says delusion, bewilderment of memory. I find that's a very interesting thing. Your smriti, your memory is bewildered. And after that, one falls, one's intelligence. Yeah, you lose your buddhi, your discrimination is lost. And you fall down into delusion, basically. Now, your memory is lost. Well, think of a time when you've had an argument with somebody. The words that come most of all, I hear in arguments is, you never listen to me. You always challenge me. Or you never do what I say. Or you never take the bins out. Or you always oppose me. Anytime someone's angry, you just challenge it. It's nearly always. When someone's angry, you use the words always and never. And now what's that? Is that true? No, you've totally forgotten the past. Nobody always does anything. Nobody never does anything. So straight away, bewilderment of memory. You forgot when he was really nice to you and he bought you a box of chocolates. And you forgot the time your daughter did those lovely things. You totally forget. What happens? First of all, you know, your desire, you've got something in front of you, you meditate on it. It's stuck to your face. So therefore, the perspective is gone. And then it's taken away from you, and you're still following it. So you can forget that memory. It's in your negative. Memory is bewildered, and your vision becomes shrunken. Shrunken vision. And it's the lollipop kid who's having a tantrum on the floor. And it's like, and I challenge you to apply that to any time you've suffered something. I mean, I can think my cowboy boots was one, and my 10-speed racer. They were the early episodes of this, and there was the end of my life. What to speak of emotion and relationships. It's like, yeah, it's the end of the world. So it's this brilliant psychological analysis of how does one lose perspective? Well, because of that, you know? If this is the purpose of Shastra, of the Mahabharata, of the Upanishads, if this is the purpose of these texts, of the Bhagavad Gita, to expand one's perspective, if Krishna's teaching to Arjuna is to expand his perspective of skin men on the battlefield, it's the complete opposite of this downward spiral. In fact, this is what yoga does. This is what these things, they're about uplifting, expanding, to the perspective that brings us down, because how you see affects how you act.
Your question is, how do you actually get free of that? Because it all starts off with thinking about an object, and then that's the beginning of the sequence, then one leads to the next, and you get the desire, and you lose yourself, lose your memory, you get totally attached to that object.
Yeah.
Or if you fail to get the desire, you get angry, then you forget everything else.
Yeah.
So that's going to happen, because I mean, like, whether you like it or not, you're going to be thinking about objects, or you're suppressing that, and that's in some ways unnatural, as we were saying earlier. You're all the time suppressing, there's a huge taboo, I mustn't think about that, I mustn't dream about that. So how do you actually get free? And that's why we're saying there has to be some realization of being part of something bigger. Because if you have that large realization, in some ways, the object and the design can't sort of like catch hold of you, can't stick a hook into you. Now, I'm not saying that I've achieved that.
No, I don't.
So because that, then in some ways, it's almost a spontaneous thing, because I have this bigger awareness. You know, an image might come up, and somehow the attachment, the desire isn't there, it just sort of fades away, another image might come up. And rather than I getting hooked into it, and this inevitable sequence happening, the spiral just doesn't happen. But if you don't have that realization, most of us will actually...
Totally agree with you. You're absolutely correct, which again goes back to the purpose and the function of Shastra, our sacred texts within Hindu tradition. What is their function? Their function is to offer perspectives. Now, the amount of time you bother to even spend with them is up to the individual, but that's what they posit to do, is actually to offer ways of reflecting on the nature of the self. It's like, say, yes, there is the the body with the social bit, and the there's these levels or layers of inter-oscillating reality all at one time. So the first thing is to actually read about it. The next thing is to reflect, like that little exercise, almost, you know, think about it. And then observe your behavior yourself. And then, again, it's a... do as you wish to do. It's up to you if this is important or not. It's entirely a person's choice. Yeah, you can live your whole life just being pushed by not even thinking about what you're doing, not even considering or reflecting. But, you know, it's not just in Greek philosophy that the unreflected life or the life is a life wasted. It's the same thing here within Hindu teachings, is that, yeah, think about what you're doing. Sorry, Julius, you wanted to say something.
Can I... Just a brief reflection.
Please, yes.
First of all, I would never dream of correcting you, Anuradha. Your presentation, not least because your presentation was so wonderful and incisive, and I agree with it all the time. In fact, just 3 points that have arisen from this from this debate. I think the Dalit who said, and this is the point you're raising, when you're talking of action and inaction and action and inaction and action. A Hindu text, if you have deep structure analysis, and that's what we're here to do, we're here for deep structure analysis, the Hindu texts are texts that provide answers, but they also generate searching questions.
Yeah, very good.
And the way they generate searching questions is through sometimes paradoxical language, to force you to think. So what is inaction? You know, they say, if for the evil to succeed, all you require is good people to do nothing. But that doing nothing is doing something. It is a form of action. It is. So the point you are making is you take responsibility for all your actions, whether they appear as action or inaction. Madhav made another point. He said, very hard to do in some point. But these are our ideals, what the text provides us with. Madhav is right, is ideals which generate a complete human existence. And because they're hard to do, it doesn't mean that they're not our ideals and we don't strive to do them. And that's what, this is our heritage. This is I say ours because I call myself a Hindu Catholic. This is our heritage. Unless we penetrate, unless we do deep structure analysis, which is what is happening in this workshop, we don't engage with the text and it doesn't affect our lives. Unless we know where we are, we take root in our culture, in our text, we can't take the beauties from other traditions and so on. That's what is being enabled in this workshop. So I think this is very, very useful, and that's why I'm glad to be part of it. So we are engaging in deep structure analysis. And the final point was made, I think, by Ranjit, who said, we're talking of a hard carapace, we're talking of a hard shell of this tortoise. And that brought a question to me, because our text asks questions, and the question is this. Can you live in this world, whether you're a business person or not a business person? Because these have to be realistic options, not just ideas. Can you live in this world without being attached to your children? Without being attached to something or the other at all? Can you proceed in total detachment? How realistic is that for a human being? To be a good mother, to be a good father, to be a good business person, a good employer? There needs to be some attachment. So to raise another question. And the question is this. What is the nature of the detachment that we are talking about? And I'm attached to my wife. I'm attached to my 6 grandchildren. And my children and so on. And we are talking now of a discipline that forces us to realize what the priorities of attachment are, how far or how much of wisdom is involved in the kinds of attachment we have, and what is the price we pay for attachment. It's not saying, you're supposed to be a zombie and not attached to your loved one. What it's saying is that there are greater and lesser attachments. And as Anuradhaji said, the attachment to Krishna, or to your God, or to your ideal, you can substitute different things there, that attachment overcomes the lesser attachments And that makes you a sthita prajna. So it's not saying you can't love your children. It's not saying that, or your wife or your spouse. And it's forcing us to ask all these questions. Which other texts do this? Now, sure, there are other texts in other religious traditions. But this is the cultural heritage of India which you are engaging with. And it's very, very important to transform your life. So it's more common.
Thank you very much.
So the question, I have a quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's a silly question, a superficial.
No question, silly.
But where is the fun in this?
Where's the fun? Where's the fun in it?
There's no California in it.
Like a very monkish, austere.
No, actually.
No, actually. No, I got away. You have to get all the
fun in this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so engaging, Azad.
Okay.
Because I'm a little confused.
Go ahead, good.
My understanding of what you said is you have to hook on to this larger Atmana consciousness in order to keep from deteriorating into a creature of your emotions and your senses.
What I'm suggesting, yes, without some realization, is it's unrealistic. Because as soon as you actually come across anything which is challenging, you're going to collapse into this kind of process. And we've all done this many times before. But it starts off with an object of thought, and then, in fact, around that, there's desire, and then you get sort of passionate, and then you lose your intelligence, you lose your memory, you're only focusing on this little thing, and you're forgetting the bigger picture. Unravel is very graphically describing when you get into an argument with somebody. You forget all the good things they've done. So I'm saying that the only way that you realistically in those sort of situations have any chance is if there is somehow you are anchored in some deeper...
Yes, hang on, I'm going to butt in. I'm going to butt in straight away. Abhyasan Vairagya, the Gita actually recommends you have to do stuff. You have to have a practice. This is like, it gives a lot, there's analogies of, yeah, the nature of the material world, I'm not going into that whole, the gunas, but, you know, dust settles. The dust kind of, the tamas brings you down. There's a kind of, the natural, you know, gravity in the universe, well, there's gravity of consciousness naturally. If you don't do any practice to uplift, to expand perspective, then the gravita, tamas, or is the nature, you actually, your perspective will be reduced.
Yeah, you have that anchor.
So, the anchor is the practice. Now, whatever the practice is, you must have a do. It's up to you. Whatever tradition you like, it could be a meditation, it could be a prayer, it could be a reading of the Gita, it could be a ritual. Hinduism has the whole range.
No, but to answer your question, how do you do it? How do you get attached to yourself? There are ways that are prescribed.
I'm just saying you have to have an anchor.
How you achieve, but...
Yeah, you understand. What I'm just saying, if you didn't have that anchor, one's bullshitting oneself. For example, if there's suddenly a fire and a disaster happening right now, you know, all these conscious values get blown away in that moment.
But
your
if you had done the practice,
you
would have found that.
Okay.
But you cannot consciously think of
it. It's great.
What I feel is that if you act, because you have to act if you're living in this world, but if you don't concentrate on the rewards of it, but acting, doing the best that you can, then you'll have less agitation in your mind, you'll have less frustrations in your mind. If the rewards don't come through, because you know you've done your best.
But like Mara was saying, how do you actually really genuinely authentically
I think your point is it's going right down to the foundation. So, you know, where do you start? I agree. And it's interesting. The Bhagavad Gita goes right back to the very, this foundational thing. It's almost like the orientation of your heart. Are you open to this reality? If there is, because of anasuyave or envy, or if there's any, you must be open to the reality. However it's nuanced is up to you, but still, the openness to some bigger reality than thinking this body, these senses, this human form is all that there is. If that's your perspective, if that's how you see it, then no, it'll be more difficult to overcome, because what's the perspective that changed that? I'm not saying, I'm not damning all humanistic perspective, but it's harder. So, yeah, a foundational thing is this whole thing behind not just the Gita, but the Gita I'm talking specifically, is, yeah, the orientation of the self. And in fact, if we go back to the narrative of the Gita, Arjuna had that one quality. Okay, he starts off, this is his perspective, completely cannot act, it's overwhelming, it's all wrong, I can't do it, despondent, depression, and inactive. But he did one thing. Despite being completely crippled and incapable of moving, he oriented his heart and said, help. Karpanya dosho pahatasva bhava prachamitvam. This help. He could do that. So what he was open to the reality beyond his limitation. That's the starting point. If that's not there, then yeah, it's round and round the mulberry bush.
And it's like you're also in the practice by which you can dip into that bigger reality, whatever your practice might be from time to time. So
that's it, but there has to be, it's like anything. If you've got a house and you have to keep it clean, dust settles on a daily basis. You know, this is an analogy that's used in the scriptures. You know, it's just the nature of the world for stuff to get dirty, to deteriorate, to decline. So if you're not actively doing something to counter this shrinking, shriveling, crippling perspective, if there isn't a something to uplift, to expand, to broaden, this mahatma, you know, big-heartedness, generosity, big perspective, the great soul is the one who has this bigger perspective. But yeah, it's a practice, and the practice is up to you. It can be anything. It depends on who you are, what your background. Then you get into the whole nuance of Hindu tradition. But the principle is the same throughout. Well, there has to be a doing, a something.
Open mind, reflective.
Discipline.
A discipline, that's what I mean. Abhyas and
the, we have a discipline in our normal lives.
You have to dust the table.
Sports men and women have a discipline. They go through certain rituals, they focus their minds, so on and so forth. It's very hard discipline. Academics have enormous discipline, working with tests, grinding their way through texts, so on and so forth. The spiritual life has a discipline too. Now, you may not be a believer, you may not believe that there's a spirit different from the body and so on, but the spirit is what I call is what makes us human, at least that. And that's what makes us different from chimps and apes. And so if there's no discipline in that dimension of our life, that's what the Gita is teaching, we can't make any progress as a human being. And that is the fundamental teaching of the Gita, the discipline, which is something that we have to embrace and embark upon.
That's right. Awareness. Yes.
You know something? Where
okay.
is the fun? That's a very good question. The real guru, the real enlightened person, is the most joyous and happy person at all. And you would see this in all religious traditions, not only in Krishna. Because you have freed yourself from all the anxieties, tensions, through this discipline that weighs you down. And so you can enjoy, you can have a joy to be, you can enjoy life in a sense of freedom. That's the best sort of fun I know. You can crack jokes, you can do this, you can do other. It gives you that freedom to enjoy the spontaneity of life. There's the fun.
Well, it's true, because the fun comes with the detachment. If you're attached to something, that causes the suffering. You can't have fun because you're so damn stuck on this thing that you can't. but if you let that go, then actually you can laugh. There's a sense of fear of loss. And I think Julius's point is really good. We're not talking about a callous, cold detachment. We're talking about being fully active in life. Remember, Krishna does not tell Arjuna to go away and be detached. He doesn't let Arjuna stop his duty. Krishna, in the end of the Gita, says, do your duty, Arjuna. Get out there on the battlefield and fight. Don't run away. Actually engage fully with a heart and a half in mind, body, spirit. Be single-minded and give your whole self, because you now have the perspective that this littleness is not all that there is. There's this bigger perspective, and the context of your littleness will take extraordinary transformation. It will become much more enriched, more whole, and more fulfilled in the context of this broader vision. And that's the purpose, like Julius was saying. It's like, yeah, it can give you a happiness that this is not all that there is. And if there is a down in your life, then that's not all that there is. There's a bigger picture. And yeah, the pain usually comes from that, about the thing that happened. You know, and you can have a lot of fun. Life becomes an adventure, actually, and it can become interesting to observe. You're saying, I'm doing that thing again, you know, the stuck on it. And yeah, it transforms. Once perspective is transformed, behavior is transformed.
Excuse me. It's almost like, to simplify, it is almost like saying, Krishna is saying to Arjuna that your dharma is to stop being self-centered and have a perspective.
Get over yourself, Arjuna.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost your dharma to have a perspective.
Yeah, it's your dharma. And we're going to read the very last verses, which ends us on dharma again. It's the, this, just to end the class, the final excerpt. This is after Krishna has spoken so many different perspectives to Arjuna. He ends. Can we continue from who was reading last? 61 to the end.
You have to.
Oh, we have to. You want me to read it?
No, I was the last to read.
Yeah.
Off you go.
The Lord of all beings is situated in the region of the heart.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. The very last one.
66.
So, for surrender to Krishna, 1861 to 1866. It's the end of the third page.
4-3.
Huh? Sorry, 4-3. Excerpt 4-3.
So it's that.
Yeah, you're correct. 61. You're correct.
The Lord of all beings is situated in the region of the heart, and he causes every being to resolve through life, mounted on the machine created by his mystical power. Maya, not a Maya.
Hmm. Next.
You should surrender to him with your entire being, Bharata, and then by his grace, you will attain the highest position, which is absolute peace.
I have now revealed to you this wisdom, which is the deepest mystery. After fully considering what you have heard, you should then act as you see fit.
Free will. Right.
Now listen again to the ultimate teaching, which is the deepest mystery of all. You are very dear to me, this is certain. Therefore, I will reveal this for your benefit.
Fix your mind on me, become my devotee, worship me and bow down to me. Then you will come to me, and this is my certain promise for you. You are dear to me.
Abandoning all types of dharma, take shelter with me alone. I will deliver you from all sins, so do not be afraid.
Sarva dharma pratyaja, mamaikam sharanam vraja. This I will deliver you. Take shelter of me alone. End of Bhagavad Gita.
Abandoning all types of dharma.
Exactly, back to Krishna's point again. Forget the whole dharma. It's just like, listen, focus on this big reality, on me, however you see, and that I'll look after.
But then that me has to be the Atma. That self which is within you.
Yeah, but he's talking about the battle.
It's that whole connection between what's happening there and what's happening there.
How you look at it. We have a Paramatma too.
That's the way I've been born.
So that's
yeah, that's okay.
No,
that's
but
fine.
This is a particular
that's good.
The battlefield.
But you don't think that way?
No, but I think in her view that Krishna is slightly different.
Well, if you just read the text.
The difference between the wave and an ocean.
If you read the text, just the way the text is saying, there's Krishna speaking, it's a dialogue between two people. So taking it like that, and of course it can be read in different ways, but taking it as Krishna is talking to, he's saying that, listen, it's a reality of relational reciprocation. That's what's been presented. And then, of course, it can be nuanced, but the point here is that he will compensate for what you lack. It's not all just up to your efforts. That there is a spiritual help available to all. That's what he's saying here. Now, again, how you wish to read that or understand it will depend on varying traditions.
Here is Krishna who said, be detached, be detached. You are seeing, you are dear to me. Mm-hmm. He's not saying that you can't love people. That's the deep structure of this text. You know, Anuraga said, reminds me of a story. I'm not sure this comes from the Mahabharata or not. I wouldn't swear to it. Dronacharya was teaching the five Pandavas how to
shoot.
Yeah,
I was thinking of that.
So he directed them towards a tree
and the bird.
Root there and a bird. So he says, Nakula Sahadeva, the twin, what do you see? Acharya, I see a bird. I see a fruit next to it. I see something. Sahadeva, what do you see? You see another fruit behind that fruit as well as the bird. Because the twins, you know, they always want to get the better of the other. Bhima, what do you see? Huh? Bhima, I see the trunk, I see the bird there, and that bird is waiting to be shot. Okay, Bhima is Bhima. Yudhishthira, what do you see? More gently, Yudhishthira says, I see what the others see as well, but I can see a touch of blue sky behind. Arjuna, what do you see?
The eye of the bird.
Shoot, Arjuna.
Yeah.
What? That is focus.
Yeah.
That's why he was chosen for the bathroom.
Exactly. I'm sorry, you just made one last question. I'm going to have to say this. It's that whole idea, somebody mentioned mind in the beginning, this mental absorption. It's about how you see the mind, where it's at. And all these practices are about disciplining the mind, yoga, meditation, the mind. But actually what Krishna is saying is that in one sense the relationship is love. Love is another meditation of the mind. So you can actually focus the mind by practice, by karma yoga. Or when you're in love with somebody, what happens to your mind?
It goes in your mind.
It becomes the most natural thing. Your mind is absorbed. So they're similar.
That's you lost it.
Yeah. It's like all the teachings are to absorb, make your mind see the bigger picture and all the ways of doing it. Or just fall in love with me, and then I will do it. Exactly. That's what the bhakti, the yoga of love, is what's being said. They're not oppositional. They're about absorption of the mind, where your mind is at, what its perspective is. And so one just happens naturally in a relational reality, and the others is through the actions and the perspective that perhaps you work at. The Gita verses we didn't get to, so I will give those to you as your personal little message from the Gita. So you take those home with you, keep them, and reflect on them as you wish to do.